Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hello, how are we doing today?
we're doing not too badly. I guess you guys are back at uni at the moment. We've got another week, so we're not back yet. So sort of in that time where you're meant to get lots done, but you never do. Anyway.
Calm before the storm.
Oh, yes, pretty much. But we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about science, as we are every week. Thanks to MOTAT. Thank you. And today we're going to talk about a lady by the name of Joy Milne. And Joy is a 72-year-old Scottish lady. And she's done amazing things. Really, really quite incredible. I think this is a fantastic story. So, she was born or has developed over her lifetime a very, very heightened sense of smell. And this sort of makes it apparently impossible for her to sort of be around anybody who's wearing perfume or to sort of, you know, walk down the perfume aisles in a, you know, supermarket or whatever because of that very, very heightened sense of smell. And when her husband was 33 years old, she suddenly figured out that he smelt different. And different to what he normally did. And then 12 years later, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. And so as a result of this, obviously the couple went to sort of Parkinson's discussions and you know, support meetings and stuff like that. And she noticed that she would smell the same smell at these meetings that she smelled on her husband. And then between the two of them, they're both medical professionals. I think he was a doctor, she was a nurse. They sort of came up with the idea, well, you know, maybe this might be a marker for Parkinson's disease. And the thing with Parkinson's disease is that there is no simple chemical test for it at the moment. Basically, you get diagnosed on the basis of symptoms. So, you know, you have to go to the doctor and you know, by the time you've got symptoms of this insidious disease, then, you know, not a lot can be done.
So how important is the early diagnosis?
Well, that really is the $64,000 question. It's hard to know because people basically don't get diagnosed at an early stage. But obviously, there was something to this. You know, the fact that 12 years before he got diagnosed, she could smell something on him. So, she was at a talk by a couple of folk from the University of Edinburgh all about Parkinson's, and at the end she put up her hand and said, why don't you use smell to diagnose Parkinson's? And they'd never heard of this before. She told them the story, and so they arranged a test for her. And what they did was that they got 6 T-shirts that had been worn by Parkinson's sufferers and 6 T-shirts as a control and asked her to sniff the T-shirts. She got all of them right, all of the 6 with Parkinson's, plus she also identified one of the controls. And 8 months later, that person was diagnosed with with Parkinson's. Yeah, wow.
That's some pretty tragic irony.
It's quite remarkable. And so therefore, these researchers thought, oh, hang on, we're onto something here. And so what they then did was to basically start taking this pretty seriously and start doing some science. And the results of this have just come out in a paper in the Journal of the American Chemical Society this week, which is the big chemistry journal out there. And so basically what they have done is to take a swab off the back of people. Okay, so just sort of below the neck. The reason being that that's not particularly well washed usually, okay? And what they are swabbing is stuff called sebum, which is basically an enormous mixture of oils and stuff on your skin, okay? And so they swab that and then they put it through a machine called a mass spectrometer. And what a mass spectrometer does is it basically shows you the number of different compounds that you've got in a particular sample, and plus it gives you some idea as to their identity as well. And so in doing this, and doing this big study, again, they were looking at Parkinson's sufferers and control people, and taking these swabs and stuff like that, and they found roughly about 4,200 different compounds in these swabs. Okay. Now, what they also found was around about 500 of these were only found on the Parkinson sufferers.
So this is something that can be replicated.
Yeah,
she won't have to go on tour.
No, this is for real. You know, this. So they're basically getting the scientific. Well, I'm using the word basically, but they're getting the scientific basis of what she is smelling. Now, you know, she can't tell you what it is she's smelling. You know, the best she can do is that she says that it's a sort of a musty odor, and so. What they have done now is basically sort of cut the number of compounds down to 500 different compounds that are particular to Parkinson's sufferers. And so knowing this, they can now, they feel, predict Parkinson's with a 95% certainty. And now this obviously is all in the lab, okay? And so it's now going to go on to, you know, clinical trials, et cetera, et cetera. And they reckon, they hope that within a couple of years, they might have this as being essentially the first sort of chemical diagnosis of Parkinson's. It takes 3 minutes. It's 95% accurate. And, you know, I think that's amazing. Absolutely incredible story.
So does this seem to be the first step towards treatment of Parkinson's?
I imagine it probably would be, because, you know, having to wait until you display symptoms, obviously then it's too late. Maybe if you can know with certainty that somebody is going to develop this somewhere down the track, then you can start looking for signs, you know, other signs of possible things that you could treat at that stage rather than having to wait for them to display symptoms. So, and this, Joy Milne, this woman who started this all, and this is tragic as well. She says that when she's walking down the street, that she can smell people who either have Parkinson's or are going to get Parkinson's. But the medical ethicists have said, look, you cannot go up to them and say, look, you've either got Parkinson's or you're going to get it.
It's quite a burden.
I would say so, you know. And, I mean, there are other examples. You know, apparently during the COVID epidemic, I think they had trained dogs that could sniff out COVID and stuff like that. And, you know, dogs have a far better olfactory system than we do. But, you know, and this is all down to the fact that this lady has got this heightened sense of smell that, you know, ordinary mortals wouldn't be able to do. So I think it makes for a fantastic story. You know, the data are all now out now in this publication. It's going to be big. And, you know, anything that can help with this nasty disease, you know, is just great. So there's the sort of the good news story for the day, sort of mixed in with sort of not quite so good, I guess, just, you know, the tragedy of the whole thing. So yeah,
more diseases.
So secondly, today we're going to talk about a plastic film that can kill some diseases, or can at least kill viruses. And, you know, that's all good. And this was brought very much to the attention, you know, back in the good old days of COVID. Remember when, you know, they were thought that COVID got into the country by sitting on surfaces and stuff like that had been imported, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody knew whether that was the case or not or whatever. But wouldn't it be great if you could have essentially a surface that would kill bugs simply by irradiating it with light in the room? And that is what some workers have done. And these are workers at Queen's University in Belfast. And what they have done is to make a low-density polyethylene film. And so it's a very, very common polymer, very, very common plastic. But what they do is they load this with 25% titanium dioxide. And some of you may have heard of titanium dioxide. That's the stuff that makes the really white paint white. And it's also stuff that you get in your sunscreens. More on that maybe a little bit later.
So we might be seeing medical areas getting even more sterile than they currently are.
Well, indeed. And so all that they need to do is they make this material. Now, titanium dioxide is what we call photoactive. So it's very good at absorbing light, especially in the ultraviolet. And what that can do is that it can allow some very sort of otherwise high energy processes to occur. And in particular, you can get formed what are called reactive oxygen species. So titanium dioxide is very, very good at that. Now, these reactive oxygen species are really, really, really reactive, and they will go around chewing up any sort of organic matter they find in their near vicinity. So this particular plastic, this plastic film, what they do, once they make it, they irradiate it with ultraviolet light for about a week. And what that does is that it basically activates the titanium dioxide in there. And then you're all set to go. And so you put it down wherever you want it. And if you've got fluorescent lighting in your room, there's enough ultraviolet light in that fluorescent lighting that can activate the titanium dioxide to form these reactive oxygen species. And then it can go its merry way and start killing all of these bugs. So they tested it on two strains of influenza A. And they tested it on COVID as well, and SARS, and it kills them. Okay, so you know this as you say, obviously it's got a myriad of uses. Sort of first and foremost, obviously in areas where you're doing anything medical, you don't want bugs on any surfaces like that. Anything where you've got food preparation or stuff like that, where you don't want bugs. But this is, this is looking pretty good. Plus, it's biodegradable to boot. So, wow. that's what we need, are biodegradable plastics. And this, I think, again, is also going to be pretty big. So,
and how does it compare to the current efficacy of sterilization?
Well, they're saying that, it just kills these bugs stone dead. So, probably as good, certainly. And you don't have to go around spraying things and stuff like that. All you need is light. And I think that's probably preferable to running around with a spray canister and, putting things everywhere. So I think probably, it's going to be a matter of watch the space. I imagine this will be out there fairly soonish, I would think.
So it's possible that we could be using this technology to combat COVID even now?
Certainly stopping it living on surfaces, yes. Yeah, yep, I think so. And, that can only be a good thing. So, yeah.
No, it's not a... not too bad news this time either.
No, not bad. And very quickly, finally, we're going to go to Spain, and specifically the Alhambra Palace. Which, all boasting aside, I have had the great privilege of seeing in person, and it really is quite spectacular.
A bit of a holiday from the virus stories.
Oh, indeed, yes. But the trouble with the Alhambra Palace is that the ceilings are turning purple, and that's not good. So back in the day when it was built originally, apparently, they tried to make it look like the inside of a cave. So the ceiling was made to sort of approximate, stalactites, isn't it? C for ceiling. Yep, so stalactites. And the way that they did that was they had it all shaped and everything, and then they would put a layer of tin foil over that, and then they would cover this tin foil with a gold and silver alloy, and that made it look apparently like stalactites. And over the years, it sort of fell into a little bit of disrepair. Now, remember, this is the Alhambra, so they just, money was no object, so they could coat the entire thing with silver and gold, et cetera, et cetera. But then they fell on sort of harder times, and what they did, it started looking not great, so they started to cover it in basically plaster of Paris, so gypsum, which, still retained the look. But after a while, the plaster of Paris started going purple, and so people sort of hadn't been able to figure out why it would possibly go purple. There were no sort of purple dyes or anything like that that could be leading to this. And so there were a bunch of researchers at the university in Granada, which is where the Alhambra is, and they took samples of this purple stuff, and they looked under electron microscope, and what they found were little balls, essentially. And these little balls had a diameter of around about 70 micrometers. And they were sort of thinking, oh, what's going on here? What are these things? And then finally, one of them had the bright idea that these were, in fact, gold nanoparticles. Okay, so normally gold just exists as a solid with an infinite number of gold atoms that are all sort of bonded to each other, et cetera, in big layers. And so you get a big three-dimensional structure built up like that. But these gold nanoparticles, these are individual atoms of gold that get together to form little balls, little spheres of gold. And what they found was that a sphere of 70 micrometers, these so-called gold nanoparticles, is exactly the right size to get purple.
Okay,
because these gold nanoparticles, depending on the size of the nanoparticles, they can display pretty much every color of the spectrum, all the way from red to violet, essentially. And so they figured out that somehow that these had formed and that they were perceiving them as being purple precisely because of their size. And they sort of figured out that, yeah, the tin must have got in contact with the gold and the silver, and you had a little bit of electrochemistry going, and these things just formed. And, you know, it's a really, really, really nice piece of
detective
work.
So it's not a combination of different materials. It's just purple-shaped gold.
It's those little gold nanoparticles that are just the right size to interact with light and absorb whatever wavelength of light, and then the light that you see reflected from it appears to our eyes purple. So, yeah, you're right. It's just basically pure gold, but in nanoparticular form. So very, very cool. Nice piece of work by these Spanish researchers.
And is this something reversible?
That's a good question. They haven't, or they didn't mention in the paper, which has just come out, whether they were looking at mitigating this, and if they were, how they would possibly go about it. I think it would be pretty darn difficult.
So you might have to go to the path of the Statue of Liberty and just accept a change in colour, right?
Well, I guess, you know, now they know what causes it. They can tell all the visitors, no, it's not some nasty drip or something like that. This is actually, you know, pure gold. So it's still gold. So, yeah, I think it's kind of cool.
Oh, very nice.
Have to go back there one day. Very nice.
Well, thank you so much, Alan. Those are some great stories.
Always good, Casper. Always a pleasure.
Really appreciate your time. And thanks again to MOTAT.
Absolutely.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.